From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss inequities in our tax system with David K. Johnston. He's reported on taxes for the New York Times for 9 years and won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of inequities and loopholes. In his new book, Perfectly Legal, he says our tax system is outdated and that it benefits the super rich at the expense of everyone else. Also, rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the Midnighters, the East Los Angeles band from the 60s that is still performing. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Gatekeeper, a recent memoir by the British literary theorist Terry Eagleton, who recently recanted his own literary theory. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Immigrants' rights groups in Arizona are pleased with President Bush's plan to provide legal rights to undocumented migrants already working in the country. Southern Arizona is the country's number one point of entry for illegal immigrants. Mark Moran reports from member station KJZZ in Phoenix.
A record number of people died in Arizona's Sonoran Desert last year while trying to sneak across the border, according to the Department of Homeland Security. The Reverend Robin Hoover, president of Tucson-based Humane Borders, hopes Mr. Bush's measure will change that by reducing the flow of foreign job seekers having to enter the country illegally.
We've known for a long time that if people can come here legally, safely, they will choose those routes and means rather than risking their lives to cross the desert. At least that's our hope.
Critics of President Bush's measure call it blanket amnesty for people who are in the country illegally and say it's a move to appeal to Hispanic voters in an election year. For NPR News, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
The president is calling on Congress to pass legislation that would create 3-year renewable visas for guest workers. 35 American soldiers were wounded today in Iraq when insurgents fired mortar rounds at a logistics base west of Baghdad. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports from the Pentagon.
U.S. Central Command says approximately 6 mortar rounds struck the sleeping area for soldiers with the 3rd Corps Support Command west of Baghdad. The logistics base is used to send supplies across a large swath of Iraq. The wounded soldiers were given first aid on site and then evacuated to a medical facility for further treatment. A Pentagon spokesman says the injured soldiers are from the 541st Maintenance Battalion out of Fort Riley, Kansas. Earlier in the day, U.S. troops west of Baghdad destroyed a home in a raid that locals said killed 2 civilians. Fallujah, Ramadi, and other cities west of the capital have been a center of violent resistance to the U.S. occupation. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Washington.
Connecticut Governor John Rowland apologized to the people of his state today for what he called mistakes and asked for an opportunity to earn back the public trust.
I was wrong when I accepted gifts given to me by state employees and from friends who do business with the state. For this, I accept full responsibility. But worse, I was wrong in failing to truthfully address these issues. I lied, and there are no excuses.
Rowland, a Republican in his third term, insisted that he never gave favors or took any action in exchange for the gifts he received. The gifts included part of the renovation of his summer cottage, including rain gutters and a hot tub. Democrats who control the state house plan to decide tomorrow whether to start impeachment proceedings against the governor. In stocks today, the Dow lost 9 points to close at 10,529. The Nasdaq gained 20 points to close at 2,077. This is NPR News. A federal judge in Houston has rejected a plea bargain that would have given a 5-month prison sentence to Lee Fastow, the former assistant treasurer of the bankrupt Enron Corporation. Fastow originally pleaded not guilty to charges of fraud, money laundering, and filing false income tax returns. Her husband, Andrew Fastow, Enron's former finance chief, is reportedly trying to work out a plea agreement with prosecutors. Enron's collapse cost investors and company employees billions of dollars. Traffic on Interstate 80 through central Pennsylvania is still snarled following a massive car and truck crash during a snowstorm. Rescue and cleanup efforts continue, and some vehicles are now getting through. Cindy Deutschman Ruiz reports from member station WPSU.
Officials have opened the eastbound lanes on Interstate 80 near State College, but backups are extensive and traffic is moving slowly. Westbound I-80 remains closed. State transportation officials say it probably will stay closed through the day as rescue workers continue searching the wreckage of around 50 cars and trucks. The massive pileup yesterday killed four people and injured at least a dozen more. Blowing snow suddenly turned into a whiteout, and within minutes, dozens of vehicles collided. Roadways are still slippery throughout central Pennsylvania. Temperatures are frigid and winds are high. Snow continues to blow as well, though not much accumulation is expected. I-80 is a major trucking and travel route through Pennsylvania. Weather along the roadway can change sharply, and winter accidents are fairly common. For NPR News, I'm Cindy Deutschman-Ruiz in State College, Pennsylvania.
In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained nearly 3 points to close at 1126. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, reminding listeners that more than 31 million Americans are at risk of hunger every day. On the web at helpstophunger.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Taxes have become one of the most politically divisive issues in America, yet the details of tax plans can be too arcane and confusing to comprehend. My guest, David K. Johnston, is a New York Times reporter who considers it his job to translate that arcane language into plain English. His articles on tax inequities and loopholes won a Pulitzer Prize for beat reporting in 2001. After 9 years of reporting on taxes for the New York Times, he has a new book about inequities in the tax system. He says the majority of Americans are supplementing the incomes and extravagant lifestyles of the rich and powerful. Johnston's new book is called Perfectly Legal. David K. Johnston, welcome back to Fresh Air. You say in Perfectly Legal that our tax system was designed in a bygone era and that it's kind of outdated. What was it designed for and how have we changed?
We adopted the income tax in this country in 1913, and the economy back then was radically different. A significant portion of people, for example, worked on or owned their own farms. And when we began the income tax, it applied only to a narrow slice of people, those who made more than what was then $4,000 a year, which was a very substantial income. The income tax since World War II, when we expanded it to be a mass tax, has been effectively designed to capture wage income, as well as income from dividends paid by publicly traded companies and interest. But the world around us is changing. And instead of having a national industrial wage economy, we are moving into a global services asset economy. And the tax system has to keep pace with that or it won't work.
So what are some of the things in the global service economy that aren't being taxed or aren't being taxed to the same extent that our wages are being taxed?
Well, people who have a lot of assets are able to organize their affairs in ways that are not recognized by the government. You know, when you get your paycheck, the amount of money that you get is reported to the government. So you can't really cheat about how much money you earned, and the government takes the money out of your check every week or month when you get paid. If you're very wealthy, you can organize yourself in a way using a variety of partnership devices, limited liability companies, offshore accounts, so that what you recognize as income and have to have reported to the government is substantially smaller than your real income. And the system, which is highly effective for wage earners, is not at all effective for those at the top, in large part because while there is this minimal reporting, there's almost no inquiry by the IRS. The IRS primarily engages in this trivial pursuit of looking at income tax returns where people's income deductions for mortgage interest and state taxes are all reported to the government, trying to find people who've chiseled a little bit here and there. It doesn't look for people who don't file, and it doesn't look for people who don't have to report their income through third parties like employers and banks.
You say that the trend for the past two decades has been this. Elected leaders have adjusted the tax system to shift the tax burden onto those with good incomes and little political power. Who are you talking about?
Me. You. Most of the people listening to this show.
Uh-huh.
There's a group of people I call the political donor class. There are about 1 in 800 Americans who account for a very large portion of campaign contributions in this country. And those people get access to politicians. You know, every politician will say, you can't buy my vote. All you get for your contribution is access. Well, basically the only people who get access are the contributors. Surprise, surprise, members of Congress go around thinking a lot about the concerns of the people who have access to them. On the other hand, people who make $50,000 to $500,000 a year generally are not involved in politics. They're not generally campaign contributors and certainly not substantial contributors. They're not people who can produce the corporate jet so a congressman can go give a speech somewhere. And those people just don't have a lot of political influence, but they have enough income that they're very attractive to squeeze for taxes.
Are the people who make between $50,000 and $500,000 a year paying more taxes than they used to?
Yes, and those people, that's the fundamental shift that's going on, goes primarily to these people. Let me give you two numbers that sort of illustrate that. In the year 2000, of all Americans, 15.3 cents of every dollar of income reported to the IRS was paid in federal income taxes. The top 400 taxpayers, and these people had an average income of $174 million each, they paid 22.2 cents in federal income taxes. That's not a lot more than 15.3. And had the Bush tax cuts been fully effective, and they weren't enacted at that point, but had they been in effect in the year 2000, those people would have paid about 17.5 cents of their income in income taxes.
Is this because they're hiding a lot of their income?
No, this is actually the reported income. This is without dealing with the unreported income that's either unrealized because of the way the law works or isn't reported at all.
So can you explain why the 400 wealthiest are paying so comparatively little?
The single largest reason is reductions in capital gains rates. When we began the income tax system and we started taxing capital gains as well as wages, the model used for congressional hearings was the life cycle of a cow. It says something about how different the American economy is today. And the argument was made back then by Republicans that you should tax capital gains at a higher rate than wages. In 1997, Congress passed what was advertised as a middle-class tax relief act. It had a child credit in it. It turned out, however, that millions of people, tens of millions of people, didn't qualify for that credit because if you paid little or no tax, that is, you were poor or working class, you didn't get it. If you were prosperous, if you made more than essentially $100,000, you didn't get the credit. It was targeted at a rather narrow group. The real important provision in terms of government revenue in the 1997 Middle Class Tax Relief Act was a reduction of capital gains tax rates from 28% to 20%. That lower rate had the effect of being, in effect, a sale. There were people who thought, well, this won't last, it won't be permanent, and so a lot of people harvested capital gains. They sold stocks, which would be publicly reported, and other assets, and realized capital gains. Of the people who made the $174 million average in 2000, about 70% of their income came from capital gains.
So this is because capital gains taxes have been cut, and then they're going to be cut more.
Right now, the rate's 15% for very wealthy people. It's as little as 5% for poor people when they have capital gains. And the clear goal and stated goal of the administration is to reduce capital gains taxes to zero.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David K. Johnston, and he reports on taxes and investigates taxes for The New York Times. His new book is called Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else. Now, you were saying that the people who are really getting hit now with a disproportionate amount of taxes are the people in the $50,000 to $500,000 income category. That's a big difference, you know, people who are earning $50,000 versus people earning half a million.
No question. That's a big swath of people, but that's the group that is most affected by something called the stealth tax or the alternative minimum tax. I need to go back in history a little bit here. In January of 1969, at the very end of Lyndon Johnson's term, there was a guy named Joe Barr who was Treasury Secretary long enough to have a cup of coffee and make one appearance on Capitol Hill. And he told Congress 3 days before Johnson's term ended that 155 Americans or American couples had made more than $200,000 in 1966 and paid no federal income tax. That's the equivalent of about $1 million today. I remember I was a police reporter for the San Jose Mercury in those days, and I remember going to the Sunnyvale Police Department and the watch commander raging about this. He was furious about it. And then going to the Mountain View, California Police Department and the desk sergeant saying, "Did you read this story in the paper?" Congress that year actually got more letters on that issue than it did on the Vietnam War, according to Professor Michael Greitz at Yale University. So Congress quickly enacted a tax designed to make sure that high-income people could not pay zero income taxes. They've changed it over the years, but the net result is that today, instead of 155 people, about 2,400 people pay no federal income tax or any income tax anywhere in the world. At the same time, Congress has allowed this law to morph into something quite different than it was. It now applies to very few people who make multimillion dollar incomes, but it can't apply to a single mother who only makes $30,000. And by 2008, according to the Tax Policy Center in Washington, which is run by the Urban Institute and Brookings, if you are a married couple with two children and you make $75,000 to $100,000 a year, there is a 97% likelihood that you will lose some of your Bush tax cuts to the alternative minimum tax, and a 42% likelihood that you will lose all of your Bush tax cuts to the alternative minimum tax. So what we're doing explicitly is we are taking money from this group of people, 50,000 to 500,000, and using it to finance tax cuts for the super rich.
Can you explain a little bit more what the criteria are for paying the alternative minimum tax? At what point does it click in for you when you're filing?
Well, the alternative minimum tax is a parallel universe. It has its own rules on what is deductible from your income and its own rate structure. But for the middle class, what makes it important is that Congress decided in 1986 so that it could balance out the revenue from the old tax law and the 1986 reforms to treat as tax shelters your exemption for yourself, your exemption for your spouse if you're married, your exemptions for your children, your state income tax, and your property taxes on your home. And if you fall into this universe of having what the government considers to be too many exemptions and deductions for these things, it begins taking them away from you and moving you into the alternative tax system. And it's a gradual process. You slide from one area to the other. If you look at line 43 on your tax return, it may have a number in there that will indicate how much you are paying an alternative minimum tax, which is essentially how much you're losing out in most cases because you took these deductions. There are also rules that apply to very wealthy people that deal with things like oil depletion allowances and various exotic areas of the tax code that only involve very wealthy people.
So for some people, some years they'll be paying the alternative minimum tax and other years they won't. What are the variables that might affect whether they pay it in a specific year or not?
Well, one of the things that's going to affect it a lot is that because the federal government has been cutting back on the money it provides for various state and local programs, state and local taxes have been rising. There's a tax shift going on here. The government saves you $500 at the federal level, and then your state taxes go up by $600, and your property tax goes up by $1,000. If you then lose the ability to deduct those state and local taxes, it causes your income tax bill to the federal government to go up and effectively takes back what you got through the Bush tax cuts.
So in other words, the more you pay in taxes, the more tax you owe because...
Yes, that's
because
exactly
your tax,
right, Terry.
Your taxes become a tax shelter and then you're taxed on the tax shelter.
That's exactly right. And the idea that, you know, your children or your spouse or your property tax on your house is a tax shelter is just absurd and clearly was not what Congress intended in 1969 when this was a big issue.
So is there any movement to change this?
Oh, there have been a couple of congressmen who've introduced bills and put copies of my story in the Congressional Record, but no, there is no serious discussion of this. The Bush administration was asked by me and some others right when they came in what they were going to do about this, and they wouldn't answer, and they wouldn't answer. And finally, the tax policy director at Treasury, a guy named Mark Weinberger, said, well, the president was elected on the promise to cut taxes, not to reform the alternative minimum tax. And after we've finished our tax cutting, we'll focus our attention on this. The administration now says that beginning in February of next year, assuming Mr. Bush is still in office, it will begin studying how to deal with this issue. In short, no, it's not on anybody's real agenda, and it's going to simply eat more and more into the incomes of people in the middle class and the upper middle class.
My guest is David K. Johnston. He reports on taxes for the New York Times. His new book is called Perfectly Legal. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David K. Johnston. He writes about and investigates taxes and the tax system for the New York Times. His new book about taxes is called Perfectly Legal. You also raise a lot of questions about Social Security, which you think the way the system operates now it's more beneficial for the rich than it is for the middle class.
Well, Social Security is a subtle and complex issue, and let me deal with one part of it first. If you are a very low-income person, the benefit you get from Social Security is greater than what you paid into the system relative to people who make more money. So in that sense, it is a redistribution scheme to provide a minimum income in old age for poor people. But there's another component that has been in effect since 1983 that makes Social Security a subsidy program for the super rich. One of the fundamental principles tax lawyers teach their clients is that a tax deferred can be a tax not paid. If you can defer paying a tax for 30 years, in effect, you haven't actually paid the tax because of the time value of the money. Under the current Social Security law, many people are paying a tax 30 years before it needs to be paid. And here's how that happened. In 1983, Congress was persuaded of the idea that Social Security would run out of money in about 31 years. And so they began raising the rates on Social Security. Currently, you pay, if you make the maximum, about $90,000, about $4,500, and your employer puts up another $4,500 that could have gone to you in wages. So you're paying a very substantial portion of your income to the Social Security system.
So can you explain some more how people with high incomes pay proportionately less for Social Security than people with lower incomes?
Well, the Social Security tax stops at about $90,000 of income. So if you make $1 million income, it's an inconsequential tax to you. There are 250,000 people in America who report a million dollar income or more. And it only applies to wages. It's what happened to the excess Social Security money that's important. This year, Americans will pay 50% more to Social Security than it will pay out in benefits. When the law was passed in 1983, the explicit promise was that this money would be used to pay off the federal deficit so that when the government got to the point that it needed to pay the boomers their Social Security, it would have the borrowing capacity to do that without disrupting the economy. Instead, the money was spent on tax cuts for the rich. The way that we have financed these tax cuts, I contend, in good part, has been by using the Social Security surplus. The Social Security surplus was not invested in stocks and bonds or anything else. It was used to finance the operations of the government at a time when we were cutting taxes on the rich. In the summer of 2001, Paul O'Neill, who was the Bush administration's first Treasury Secretary, went to a meeting at the top of the World Trade Center with a group of Wall Street types who want to privatize Social Security so they can collect fees for managing those accounts. And he entered the room and said, I am here today as the chairman of the Social Security Trust Fund. We have no assets. All we have are the future promises of the American people to pay the taxes to cover Social Security. So if you make $90,000 or less, this year you will pay 50% more than needed into the Social Security system, and that money will go to finance tax cuts for the super rich.
Of course, that's not the way it's being presented to us.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. What's being presented is there's this coming disaster where we won't be able to pay Social Security. Well, given the enormous budget deficits that we are running right now, that's true. We're going to run up an enormous amount of debt far into the future under our current spending policies. The government right now is spending $500 billion a year more than it is taking in. Now, in the short run, that's classic Keynesian economics, and the current president is the biggest Keynesian of all times, and the current economy is probably doing much better than it would otherwise, but for the government spending all this money, it doesn't have. But you cannot go on forever spending money you don't have without serious consequences. And those serious consequences are likely to come due about the time that the boomers start retiring, large numbers of them. And when that happens, the boomers may discover that there's not enough money there to pay Social Security.
Boomers are going to be ready to retire in a few years. And that will put a lot of stress on the Social Security system. At the same time, I think coinciding with a lot of the boomers retiring at the end of this decade, there are new tax cuts that are delayed to go into effect until close to the end of the decade, yes?
Well, most of the Bush tax cuts are now in place. The one exception is the estate tax, which is eliminated for the single year of 2010 and then reinstated unless Congress takes some other action on it. But because of these tax cuts, unless there is enormous economic growth of a kind that we've never seen before that leads to new tax revenues because of economic growth, there simply is not going to be enough money out there to pay the interest on the federal debt, fund the normal operations of the government, pursue this war, which may go on not just for your and my lifetime, but forever if it's a war on terrorism, since I can show you examples of terrorism in the Old Testament, and provide for the retirement of the boomers. I mean, we just do not have a sound fiscal policy relative to taxes.
David K. Johnston reports on taxes for the New York Times. His new book is called Perfectly Legal. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Carrie Scheider's American Yoga, The Paths and Practices of America's Greatest Yoga Masters, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, this is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the East L.A. band The Midnighters. Maureen Corrigan reviews the new memoir by the British literary academic superstar Terry Eagleton. And we continue our discussion about inequities in the tax system with journalist David K. Johnston. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David K. Johnston. He's been reporting on taxes for the New York Times for the past 9 years. In 2001, he won a Pulitzer Prize for beat reporting for his articles about tax loopholes and inequities. Now he has a new book about inequities in the tax system called Perfectly Legal. One of the main issues that you write about in your new book is the ways in which the very wealthy can avoid paying taxes on their income. And you write that just as there's an underground economy for the people who are very poor and have to work in kind of the illegal part of the American economy, there's also an underground economy for the very rich, an underground economy that allows them to hide a lot of their income. Can you give us some of the examples that you find most egregious of this upper class underground economy?
Sure. Well, one of the biggest is this issue of using offshore accounts. You take untaxed income, you put it into an account in the Cayman Islands or the Bahamas. There are banks that advertise this. You then get a MasterCard, or if you're really smart, a debit card, and you use it to tap that account and draw money out of it. Here in Manhattan, Robert Morgenthau, the district attorney, who's been very aggressive in pursuing tax cheats, found a fellow who used a debit card to withdraw $800,000 in less than a year by going around to various banks to tap this money. They've been unable to find that particular guy, by the way. So that's one example. Secondly, there are the use of offshore nonprofit entities called 501c27s. These are tiny mutual insurance companies. One man in New York City, Peter Kellogg, who's one of the biggest forces on Wall Street, has two of these companies, and through them, he earned more than $500 million in investment profits on which he paid no taxes. These little entities, these little mutual insurance companies, are supposed to be tax exempt so long as they don't have revenues, insurance premium revenues, of more than $350,000 a year. Mr. Kellogg's companies had revenues of about $30,000 a year, but he deposited $100 million into it and then allowed the money to grow through investing offshore. Then you have hedge funds. Hedge funds are basically unregulated mutual funds that operate offshore. There are several managers of hedge funds who, in their personal accounts, have built up more than $1 billion. And some of these guys are in their 30s. And they can, as long as they keep the hedge fund going, that money will sit there untaxed. To think that it will ever be taxed, that the IRS will pursue it and know about it years from now, is, I think, just a fantasy.
And you also think that we should be rethinking how corporations are taxed. What are some of the hidden profits in corporations now that you think should be taxed that aren't?
Well, I think we need to address fundamentally the issue of whether we're going to tax corporations at all or not, or have the tax attributes of corporations flow to the owners. This is a really complex problem. The tax system is sort of like a game of pickup sticks. If you move any one stick, the whole dynamic of the pile can shift in ways that you don't expect. So this is not a simple question. And in a world in which you can own a stock for 1 minute, how you deal with the tax attributes of it is different than someone who, say, owns their own corporation. But we allow corporations in a multinational world to earn profits overseas in places where they appear to be taxed but are not really taxed by the governments there through very complicated structures. And so long as you reinvest that money offshore, you're never taxed here in the United States. Furthermore, you can do a really neat little trick. Let's say you've built up $1 billion of profits offshore and you don't have any new factory you want to build, so you put that money in cash and you invest it, and let's say you get 5% on it. Then you go to your bank and say, we want to borrow here in the United States $1 billion guaranteed by the $1 billion offshore, and you pay 6% of that money. Now you get a tax deduction in the United States for the interest that you're paying. And there are just a million schemes that are so complicated they make your head explode that are all designed to earn profits as reported to shareholders, but not earn profits as reported to the IRS. Now, the fundamental reform I think we should examine is eliminating this system that requires two sets of books, one for the IRS and one for the corporation.
Now, another technique for avoiding paying taxes on income that you write about is this, that a lot of companies are moving their intellectual properties to offshore addresses. Would you explain how that works?
Well, imagine that you're a chemist at one of the big drug companies and you're working on some project and you suddenly discover you have a product that is going to make everybody unbelievably beautiful if they just buy this pill. The first thing that's going to happen is the you'll tell your boss will tell the lawyers, the tax lawyers will be brought in, they'll sit you down in a room, they'll say, I want every scrap of paper connected with your research. They'll put it in an envelope and send it to Switzerland, where they will create a little entity that will own this intellectual property. Now, they have to pay the American company for that. So they'll funnel money to this paper entity they created in Switzerland. It'll write a check for, say, $100,000 to the U.S. company, which will report it as income. The product finally gets on the market. Imagine the price you would pay for a pill that makes you beautiful, right? The pill costs $100 a pill, and $10 of that is the royalty for the intellectual property. That $10, or maybe it's $50 or $90, then becomes a tax-deductible expense of the drug company in America, which is sent to the Swiss entity, which in turn sends it to a Luxembourg entity, where it sits as untaxed profits that can be reinvested anywhere in the world.
Now logos, you say, are being moved to
as copyrights, logos, patents, mm-hmm. any kind of intellectual property that you can, you know, write down on a piece of paper and send offshore.
Now, with logos, I mean, a company's logo appears on the packaging of just about everything it sells. So does that mean that for many companies, there's a percentage of every product that's sold that goes to this offshore account because of the logo that's on it?
Yes. And in fact, some of the companies, when they've moved offshore, have changed their logos. So that if a company simply moves offshore, there's a tax rule that requires them to take a relatively small royalty for their brand name of their products or the symbol that they stamp on their products. If they then instead modernize that logo, you know, they give it a new look, then they can charge a much higher rate on the royalty, and that royalty payment becomes a tax-deductible expense in the U.S. and is transferred offshore. Similarly, when you move a company offshore, you loan money back to the United States so that the U.S. company ends up having no capital of its own or very little. There are some rules that require them to have some capital. But you borrow money offshore and loan it to the U.S. company, and those interest payments that are paid then back to the parent company offshore become tax-deductible expenses. When the Ingersoll Rand Company, they make the jackhammer and refrigeration equipment and heavy industrial equipment, moved to Bermuda. They paid the Bermuda government a $26,000 a year fee to have a mailbox there to accept mail and have it as their tax headquarters. And they estimated that in the first few years, they would save $40 million a year in U.S. corporate income taxes. So they get all the benefits of operating in the U.S., access to the U.S. market, the courts to enforce their contracts, the labor laws, and access to this incredibly rich market. But they don't pay for those benefits. Instead, they pay the Bermuda government $26,000 a year.
And one of your points is that you can't get away with anything when it comes to your taxable income, but when corporations make these huge profits, there's all kinds of schemes of hiding it.
Yes. The tax system is very efficient and effective for wage earners. It is not for everybody else. And we have radically reduced the number of auditors at the IRS. We've reduced the number of criminal investigative agents. And we've diverted many of those to working on the war on drugs and the war on terror instead of on tax crimes. And then Congress has imposed a whole variety of new procedural rules that slow down the audit process. And it is simply a completely unmatched game in which those who are smart and have lots of lawyers and accountants can pay what they choose to pay in income taxes.
David K. Johnston is my guest. He reports on taxes and the tax system for the New York Times. He's won a Pulitzer Prize for his work. His new book about taxes is called Perfectly Legal. You have analyzed the Bush administration tax cuts in the past on Fresh Air, but I'm interested in hearing now what you think the effect of these tax cuts will be while coinciding with the new expenses that we've taken on in Iraq.
Well, there's no period in our history before where we have entered into a war, and then at the same time, rather than demanding some economic sacrifice from people, cut their taxes, particularly at the top. When the when World War I was being fought, the war to end all wars, the estate tax was implemented, and the political argument of the day was that if you were going to conscript the lives of young men to protect America, then you should also conscript the fortunes of the wealthy to protect America. So this is an extraordinary change in public policy, and it's not economically sustainable over a long period of time because the government is spending currently $500 billion a year more than it's taking in. And in the long run, we cannot sustain that, and we will pay a price for it. I can't tell you how we're going to pay the price. That's going to be one of those shocks. But if we continue on this road, it is going to hurt, and it's going to hurt for a long, long time.
What would you predict is the time when it's going to start to hurt? When
the markets conclude that the United States government is behaving like a third world, as Ronald Reagan used to say, tin horn dictator. When the markets lose confidence in the United States, there will be an abrupt withdrawal of our capacity to borrow money from overseas. How the results of that will play out, nobody knows, but it will happen.
And you think this loss of confidence would come when overseas markets realize that we are so in debt?
Correct. When the debts become just too sustainable. I mean, it's just like if you're an individual and you keep borrowing and borrowing and borrowing, there comes a point where you can't even sustain the minimum payments on your debt and you fall into economic collapse.
A lot of people are going to be angry and frustrated because of what you've said about some of the inequities in the tax system. And they might feel, well, geez, if the corporations are cheating, if the wealthy are getting away with a lot, I'm going to try to get away with more on my taxes. You say in your book that you urge people not to cheat on their taxes.
I think, first of all, you can't cheat very much because your income and your principal deductions are all reported to the government. All you can do is chisel a little bit. You can overstate your charitable gifts. You can overstate your property taxes. You can't do anything of any consequence. I think, therefore, if you resist the temptation to do that, it's going to make you angrier. It's going to make you more involved in thinking about the government, in taking the time to call your congressman's office, to write letters, to say to your neighbors, to talk about public policy issues. You know, it's unfortunate in this country more people seem to be concerned with which movie star is sleeping with who than about how we're financing our democracy. And so I think the first step is that reform has to begin with you and with your personal integrity about the system, because it puts you in a mental frame and in an emotional state and a position of integrity to really complain about this.
David K. Johnston, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
David K. Johnston reports on taxes for the New York Times. His new book about inequities in the tax code is called Perfectly Legal. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on the Midnighters. This is Fresh Air. Although the usual way to think about rock and roll in America is to dwell on the tension between black and white music, in some parts of the country there was another color, brown. East L.A. was a hotbed of musical activity in the 1960s, and no band was as popular back then as the Midnighters. Today, 40 years after they began, they still draw huge crowds to their reunion shows. Rock historian Ed Ward has their story.
Tell me that it's over. Whoa, whoa. Well, all right. I'll let you go free. But baby, though it may be over for you, it'll never be over.
There's a philosophy of band leading that says you have to be able to play it all, the hits, the standards, and a touch of your own stuff. This philosophy usually leads to a band that's making lots of money playing wedding receptions and teen dances, but never gets to record or tour. But it's different when you're working in a tightly knit ethnic community like East Los Angeles was in the 60s, and the Midnighters' continuing success is proof of that. The band sort of fell together around 1963 and became known as an all-purpose unit that could play anything from Mexican standards to Las Vegas show tunes, which is how they picked up a gig backing Cannibal and the Headhunters at East Los Angeles College in 1964. Cannibal and the Boys were also from East L.A., and their big number was a cover of Chris Kenner's hit Land of a Thousand Dances. The Midnighters had rehearsed Cannibal's whole set, but his bus had gotten lost on the way to the gig. So after their opening set was over, the Midnighters stayed on and did the headliner's show. Someone recorded it, and the next thing they knew, the Midnighters had their first record out. As you can hear from this 1966 re-recording, lead singer Little Willie G, Willie Garcia to his parents, had a voice that could belt but could also croon. This was the side of the Midnighters that the parents loved and got the band plenty of work.
This is not the first time it's happened before. Oh, the girl that I love doesn't love me anymore. So I'm at it, forget it, don't want it, you've got it. I'm giving up on love before love gives up on me.
But the side that made them immortal was a throwaway intended for the B-side of a single. It emerged as they were jamming on a Rolling Stones tune and became an East L.A. anthem.
Let's take a trip down Willow Boulevard!
Arriba, arriba!
It was this sort of proto-punk music that began to widen their appeal outside of the barrio, and which has continued to cause people to seek out their three albums. Because even though Cannibal and the Headhunters' version of Land of a Thousand Dances had outsold theirs, the Midnighters had a career that far outlasted Cannibal's. That said, even with great workouts like Jump, Jive, and Harmonize, the band never cracked the national market. Given the size of Los Angeles, they played out a lot, did well, appeared on radio and television, and toured a bit in the surrounding areas. But after 6 years, things were changing, and in 1969, the Midnighters called it a day. They left, however, with a bang. Chicano Power was the band's last single, and it signaled Willie G's departure from the band. Some of the guys regrouped in 1983, but it wasn't until his old high school was in trouble and was holding a benefit that Willie G came out of retirement and joined his former bandmates for a reunion show. It worked just fine, and today they get together a couple of times a year just to show East L.A. what it was like when the Midnighters owned the place.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the memoir by British academic superstar Terry Eagleton. She says it's horrifying and hilarious. This is Fresh Air. Across the country, colleges and universities are gearing up for the start of a new semester. To mark that occasion, book critic Maureen Corrigan decided to review the recent paperback edition of a memoir called The Gatekeeper by superstar scholar Terry Eagleton, who's been called the last Marxist literary critic. Here's her review.
British academic superstar Terry Eagleton made his name as a cultural theorist. In fact, his genial, best-selling 1983 book, Literary Theory, An Introduction, is still the text most English graduate students and their professors consult when they need to brush up on the difference between secular humanism and hermeneutics. So it's big news in a small pond that Eagleton has now renounced cultural theory as beside the point in this age of terrorism. In his latest book, called After Theory, which is being published in the United States this month, Eagleton laments that literary scholars are preoccupied with relativistic meditations on their navels and other body parts instead of big moral questions like truth and the nature of evil. No argument there, but let's not talk about theory or after theory. In my own small way, I anticipated Eagleton's recantation years ago when I became disenchanted with high literary theory and its members-only linguistic opaqueness. I want to vault over the whole scholarly slingshot fight that after theory has already provoked and take cover in another and undoubtedly more entertaining and probably more important recent book Eagleton wrote. The Gatekeeper is Eagleton's memoir. It came out in paperback late last year, and I've just gotten around to reading it. It's by turns horrific, reluctantly moving, and so packed with go-for-the-jugular, hilarious academic anecdotes that it makes perfect sense that, as Eagleton tells his readers, he's been asked for his autograph by people at lectures thinking he's Terry Jones of Monty Python. As he acknowledges, Eagleton's life story corresponds to that most archetypal of British post-war tales, the climb of the promising scholarship boy out of a working-class Valley of the Ashes. These angry young men make good stories all follow the same broad plot, But the special ones, like Eagleton's, distinguish themselves through the pitiless intelligence of their vision. The very thing the angry young man in question struggles to attain through an elite education. Eagleton's death in life dump was Manchester, England, in the late 1940s and 50s, where he grew up a sickly child in a large family of Irish Catholics. He says, "We led a cowed, daunted existence, socially sophisticated enough to be conscious of our social inferiority. Our aim in life was to have the words, 'We were no trouble,' inscribed on our tombstones." The title of Eagleton's memoir derives from his Catholic schoolboy duty of escorting the weeping families of newly cloistered Carmelite nuns out to the gate of the convent, never to see their daughters again. Eagleton was the only kid in his grammar school class to own a coat. But before he can be accused of stooping to melodrama, he describes how he and his hungry classmates so stuffed themselves with cheap beetroot that they would regularly vomit up the maroon mess all over their desks. That reflexive need to undercut, not to take oneself or one's life situation too much in earnest, is, as Eagleton recognizes, a mixed blessing legacy of growing up working class and Irish Catholic. His wit is most overpowering when he's describing the endlessly self-fracturing socialist groups he joined as a young man, and his purgatorial stint as a scholarship student at Cambridge, a place then populated with professors who taught by declaiming poetry out loud. Studying English, Eagleton comments, seemed largely a matter of the stomach muscles. The mood shifts again, though, when Eagleton ends his memoir with a stunning anecdote describing how he got that Cambridge scholarship, almost literally by stepping over his factory worker father's dead body. "What if others win for you, by their sacrifice, the very largeness of mind which might tempt you to betray them?" That's how Eagleton elegantly poses the moral conundrum of the up-from-the-working-class memoirist. The fact that throughout his career Eagleton has been sensitive to moral conundrums has always elevated him some notches above most of his fellow theory heads.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Terry Eagleton's memoir, The Gatekeeper. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Iron Fire, a novel of the Knights of Malta and the Last Battle of the Crusades by David Ball, author of Empires of Sand. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with two Bush administration insiders about the war on terrorism. David Frum was special assistant to President Bush, and Richard Perle chaired the Defense Policy Board. They both describe themselves as hardliners. Their new book is called An End to Evil: How to Win the War on Terror. Join us for the next Fresh Air.